días.
Guten Tag.
Buongiorno. Bonjour. Ohayou gozaimasu. Dobroyo utro.
Karimera.
G'day.
Welcome to Wider Horizons, a program devoted to exploring different points of view on what we believe. What we believe about the world around us and any other worlds, about human nature and who we are, and about the relationships among humans, between humans and the natural world, and between humans and any spiritual world. I'm your guide for this journey, Nick Schweitzer, no more qualified to lead this than many of you are, but interested and willing to do so.
This is the second of six lectures on world religions, coordinated by the Reverend Michael Schuller of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of Madison, presented at Oakwood Village, starting on October 4th, 2007. For more information about this series of lectures, or about the citywide low-power FM station and its programming, visit citywidelpfm.org.
For those of you who are here for the first time, I'm Michael Schuller. I'm the parish minister of the First Unitarian Society and the person who at the request of some of our members organized this series of addresses on the world's religions. This is the second in this series, and our focus exactly will be on Judaism. That we follow next week with a presentation on the basics of Christianity, Reverend Jeff Wild from Madison Christian Community, and then I'm going to be addressing Islam the week after that. David Creswell will be talking about Buddhism following that, and I've just recruited an individual from the Mass Hindu community in our last lecture to tell us a little bit about the basic premises and practices of Hinduism. So we're all set for now until the end of the series. Marty is the rabbi at Congregation Jewish Maya, which is a Reconstructionist Jewish synagogue. I should probably tell you a little more about what that means and how it may differ from Reform or Conservative or Orthodox. Been around Madison for several years now, and we're actually looking forward to the possibility in the future of our new building in the Spanish University of Texas side to actually have some worship space with Congregation Jewish Maya. So we're hoping for a very collaborative and productive relationship in the future. I'll let Lori provide any more introduction that she might have. So thanks for being here.
There's a lot to cover about Judaism, and if you want me to cover absolutely everything in Judaism in 1 hour, I'm going to have to talk so fast that you won't be able to understand me. So I'm going to start from the beginning saying we're not going to be able to cover everything. I'm going to actually try to keep my comments fairly brief so then I can hear from you what you're most interested in. Let me tell you just a little bit about who I am and where I'm from. As Michael said, I'm the rabbi of Congregation Shari Shemayim. We're a Reconstructionist congregation. There's a Reformed temple here, a Conservative congregation, and a Reconstructionist congregation. And we're the smallest of those movements. We don't have any Orthodox congregations in Madison. There's an ultra-Orthodox group that does meet, but the three main, I would say, branches of Judaism in Madison, Reform, Reconstructionist, and Conservative. And we fall somewhere in between Reform and Conservative. So we have a little bit more Hebrew and more tradition than Reform, but less Hebrew and less tradition than Conservative. That's a very, very basic way of explaining everything, and that's may not be so helpful. So I will, I'm happy to explain more if you're interested in that. But I want to start with the very basics of Judaism. Judaism is the religion of the Jewish people. Anyone know how many Jews there are in the world? Any guesses? No guesses. I heard 9 million. Great. Anything else? Well, that was very close. It's actually 14 million. So very close. There are a little over 5 million Jews in the United States, a little over 5 million Jews in Israel, and the rest of the Jews are scattered throughout the world. And so we're going to go way, way back to the time of Abraham. And according to Jewish tradition, the history of Judaism begins with the covenant between God and Abraham. So we're talking thousands of years ago. And Judaism is among the, one of the oldest religions in the world that is still in practice today. And just as far as basic religious principles, because again, there are many, many, many principles, but Jews believe in one God who created the universe. God established a covenant with the Israelites, and the Jewish people are descendants of the Israelites. God revealed the laws and commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai. And I'm going to interrupt myself by saying that's the very traditional belief that God dictated the Torah being the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, to Moses on Mount Sinai. Moses wrote it all down, and that's the Bible that we have today. The scholars, will say that God didn't actually dictate it in that way, but that the Torah is pretty much a compilation of many, many different texts. That there were several scribal schools who were all writing in ancient Israel, and those texts all got spliced together. And so there are lots of different views. Liberal Jews believe much more in what we call documentary hypothesis, a long word to say that the Torah is not literally the word of God. It wasn't literally dictated to Moses by God at Mount Sinai, but instead is a product of the people living at that time. And it is very sacred, and it's sacred because generation after generation of Jews have read the text, have struggled with the text, have learned from the text, have created traditions from the text, and have written commentaries upon commentaries about the text. And that's what makes it sacred. And that God is very much part of the text and part of the tradition, and we do very much believe in one God, but I, as a liberal rabbi, don't believe that God actually dictated it to Moses at Mount Sinai thousands of years ago. And just a little bit of history here. Abraham, anyone know a little bit about Abraham? Yeah, okay, a little bit about Abraham. So Abraham rejected idolatry, and he's sort of known as the father of the Jewish people. He gave birth to two children, two sons, Ishmael and Isaac. And Isaac is where the Jewish people continued from. And Isaac is going to continue Abraham's work within the Jewish tradition. And when you learn about Islam, you'll learn about Ishmael and how that tradition got created. And then we are going to fast forward a lot to the time of Jacob. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are considered the three patriarchs of Judaism. So we're going to fast forward to Jacob. And this was the time when God sent Jacob and his children to Egypt, and they would become enslaved, and the Israelites would be in Egypt for many, 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 many hundreds of years. And then we have the Great Exodus, where the Israelites left Egypt, the sea split, they went through the sea and into the wilderness. So that was also a very central story in Jewish tradition. And one of the reasons why it is such a central story is because we tell it every single year at Passover. And Passover is a holiday that happens in the spring. And during this time of Passover, we retell the story of the Exodus. And it's common in Jewish families to not only tell the Exodus of Israelites, but to also look at our world today and say, well, who else is enslaved today? Who else is oppressed? And what can we as Jewish people do about it? And what does our tradition tell us about it? Because Judaism talks a lot about the importance of freedom and the importance of justice and of creating a world that is a far, far better place than what we live in now. There's a term called tikkun olam, which tikkun means a repair, and olam is world. So the idea is the repair of the world. And what Passover teaches us, but what many of the Jewish texts teach us, is that our job as Jewish people is to repair the world and to create justice in our world. And we do that in many different ways, and it's a central value. We also have many other central Jewish values. Another one is Gemilut Chasadim, which is acts of loving kindness. And those acts are what form the foundation of Judaism. So the idea of visiting the sick, or caring for the elderly, or feeding the poor, feeding the hungry, all of these things are central Jewish values. I got a little bit off track, but we're going to just fast forward. We're going to biblical history like you wouldn't know it. We're going to keep going. We're going to get to the time of Moses and Moses' brother Aaron. Become Aaron and his followers sort of become the priestly class and within the Israelites community, and they're going to then be in charge of temple worship in Jerusalem. I'm going to fast forward us even more to the time of Jesus, which is a time that a lot of people who are not Jewish relate to because of Christianity. And this is the time of the year of 70, it's a little bit after Jesus, but the year 70 was when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and the Israelites were sent into, or the I couldn't say Israelites anymore, but the Jews were sent into exile. And this is where Judaism changes in very profound ways, because without the temple and the priestly class, this was where, this was so central to Judaism. We had sacrifices, and we had the whole cult of the temple worship. And this is a really important part of Judaism. It was the way that our ancestors prayed to God. Now, without the temple, it was no longer possible to pray to God in that way, through sacrifices. So the rabbis came around, and they said, Judaism is going to have to change in some really important ways. And one of the ways that it changed was they said that instead of these animal sacrifices, as that's the way of relating to God, prayer is now going to be the way of relating to God. They called it the sacrifice of the heart. And this is where prayer becomes really important in Judaism, at the first part of the millennium. The rabbis were the ones who wrote down what we have is the Mishnah, and the Mishnah comes around 200 of the Common Era. So after the construction of the temple, after Jesus, and the Mishnah was all of the records of all of the explanations of the Jewish tradition. So I need to back up a little bit. Remember when I said that very traditional Jews believe that God dictated the Torah to Moses at Mount Sinai? Well, that was what became known as the written law. Torah Shebichtav, that's written law. But there's also a tradition that traditional Jews or Orthodox Jews believe, and that is about the oral law, the oral law or the oral tradition. And the idea was that that was also dictated to Moses at Mount Sinai, but because it was oral, it was just passed down verbally generation to generation. And then you come the time of when the Jews were exiled from the land of Israel, and they're spreading out all over the world, and there was this real fear, how was Jewish tradition going to be maintained? The oral law, has anyone ever played the game telephone, or maybe your grandchildren play this game telephone? Well, what you sit in a circle, one person starts and has a sentence, and they whisper it into the person's ear sitting next to them. And that person whispers it into the ear sitting next to them. You go around in a whole circle, and when you come back, do you think the person who's the very last person says the exact same thing as the beginning? No, of course not, because lost in transmission is what the original ideas were. And so the same thing with the oral law, the oral tradition. There was a great fear that when you had Jewish communities spreading out to all these different places, the Middle East, what we call now the Middle East, or Europe, that all the oral law would be lost, because, you know, if it's just, you know, verbal and people are all spread out, there would be no concrete way of preserving it. So the rabbi said, we're going to write it down. So they wrote down the oral law, and this was known as the Mishnah. And these were commentaries about the written law, commentaries on the Torah. So they wrote it down, but not only did they write it down, but then there were people who came after them who had commentaries about that. And there's this whole tradition, very central to Jewish thought, of what's called the Talmud and Talmudic discourse. So we have the Mishnah around the year 200, but then over the next three centuries came another text that got written down called the Gemara. And the Mishnah and the Gemara together form the Talmud. And so this, the Talmudic discourse is really important in Judaism because we don't just have the Torah, we also have the Talmud. And the Talmud, or the oral explanations that got written down, but it's all the commentaries and the stories and the explanations of the Torah. For example, I'll give you an example here. Going back to Passover, when this idea that the Israelites left Egypt, they were going and they were walking, and here is the Red Sea, and there's great terror because how are they going to pass through the sea? God splits the sea, they go through it, and then the sea comes back together, and the Egyptians are all killed. So that's what's in the Torah, but now there's what we call a midrash, which is a rabbinic story. From the Talmud that says that all the angels were rejoicing that they were so happy that the Israelites made it through and the Egyptians were all killed. And the story goes, God says, wait a minute, why are you cheering? Why are you celebrating? The Egyptians are also my children. This is not something to be rejoicing about. And from that story we learn that we are all God's children, and that we are all sacred individuals, and that just because the Torah is just the basic story, we have all these other stories added on top to give us new ways of looking at it. So, lest we think that the Talmudic tradition ended in the year, let's say, 500, and these years are very fuzzy, but let's say the year 500, there were more and more and more commentaries that got written after that. You had other rabbis and other communities who started writing their own commentaries. And then we're going to fast forward into the medieval period. Then we have people like Moses Maimonides, who was a medieval philosopher, who was incredibly important to Jewish tradition. We had a guy named Rashi, who was a medieval rabbi, who also was incredibly important to Jewish tradition. And their commentaries and their ideas have also formed a really core part of Jewish tradition. We're going to keep on fast-forwarding, and we're going to get to the modern period. And modern Jewish thought has also shaped Judaism to a great extent. We have philosophers like Martin Buber or Franz Rosenzweig, who also gave us new ways of looking at Judaism. And then we're going to fast-forward to the contemporary period, the period we live in now. We have many, many rabbis who are still writing commentaries. And because we live in such a democratic culture now, we have people who are not rabbis who are also saying, well, Judaism and Jewish tradition, if this is my tradition, and I'm going to write my own ideas. If there's all different sorts of midrashim that are being written today, anyone can look at the Torah and look at the traditions and think, why did it say this? Why did it say that? Why didn't it say this? And, you know, there's something that really seems to be missing in the story, so I'm going to write my own story about that. We don't call that Torah. We don't call that. That's not part of our original text, but it's a modern or contemporary commentary on that. And Judaism is always evolving throughout time. I told you at the beginning that I'm Reconstructionist, and one of the core beliefs of Reconstructionist Jews is that Judaism is the evolving religious civilization of the Jewish people. So I'm going to unpack that, because that was a lot. So by evolving, as I explained through all that history that I gave you in about 7 minutes, through all that history, Judaism is always changing. We always have new ideas. The God that people believed in the Bible is really different from the God that people believed in the medieval period or the contemporary period. And so that's always changing. All sorts of beliefs about Jewish law, because Judaism is a law-based religion. Those ideas, our relationship to Jewish law, has also changed. As a Reconstructionist Jew, I don't follow halakha, Jewish law, precisely. I use it much more as a moral guide. But my Orthodox colleagues, my conservative colleagues, very much see Jewish law as something that shapes their Jewish practice and their Jewish lives. So that's also what we mean by evolving. Religious, that's obvious. Civilization, that Judaism is a religion. It's also a culture and a people and a language and a land, all of these different things. We talk about Jewish peoplehood, that we talk a lot about people because Judaism is not what you believe as much as what you belong to. So I could wake up tomorrow and say, I don't believe in God. I'm not interested in practicing Judaism. I'm just not interested in that. And any rabbi would tell you, I'm still Jewish. So it's not about belief. We obviously do have many, many beliefs, and many, many Jews do believe that, but there are Jews who believe all sorts of different things. When we say, what's the Jewish view of death? Or what's the Jewish view of homosexuality? Or anything like that. You get a very long answer because there's no one answer. There's many, many different answers because as a civilization, it's not just a religious belief. And we don't have one central authority. We have no equivalent of like a priest or the Pope. And so there's many rabbis writing many different things. There's many different texts. If anything, it's Jewish texts are what guide us and rabbinic interpretations of those texts. But there's many, many, many different ideas. So there's no one Jewish belief about most things. That being said, there's Jewish consensus over many things. So evolving religious civilization, again, of the Jewish people. And Jewish peoplehood is really what is central. So I'm going to stop talking. Maybe you had a question about something totally different. You want to know about Jewish weddings, or you want to know about Jewish holidays, or you want to know about Israel, or anything like that. I can't say that I'm going to answer every single question in the depth that you would like, but I will do my very best.
I had a question about that little chunk of history you left out about how the Jews got from the desert to the temple in Jerusalem. That you left out that.
Ah, okay. I left out a lot of the history.
What did you thought about that?
How the Jews, let me see if I understand your question. How the Jews, the 40 years in the wilderness?
How we left from the wilderness.
Okay.
The growth of the Tanakh tradition, I think it's kind of what we're talking
what
about.
What was that?
You start from Aaron and
out
of the wilderness and occupy Old Canaan. Well, how does that, if they ask that, a little more detail on that.
Okay. So the current contemporary thoughts. Well, I'm going to start there. So when you say the current thoughts, there's two things that go up in my mind. One is, what are rabbis of our generation saying now, either very traditional or liberal? And what are archaeologists saying now? Because that's also really important. And because I'm a liberal rabbi, I very much see that as very important. So I don't know a lot of the archaeological history, so I'm not going to give you a lesson on archaeology. But I will tell you, I would say the best way for me to answer that is to explain to you Torah study, what happens at our synagogue every Shabbat morning. So throughout the year, we cover the entire Torah. Again, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. So Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So each week we study a different portion of that. So right now we're just starting Genesis. So we're this Shabbat, this Saturday morning, we're going to be talking about Noah. And then, you know, several months from now it'll be Exodus, and then Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. So your question, the way I'm going to answer it is, what's happening in the desert? What's happening? And at our Torah study, one of the things that we do is we read the text and we talk about the text and we read some really problematic things in the text. And what happens when you read a problematic text? For example, what's something problematic? Oh, I know. There are several times in the desert when all sorts of things happen, like many, many people are killed, let's say. There's a war. There are plenty of wars in these texts, and there's a lot of violence. There's texts of terror, is what one one person called them. And so we really talk about those. And what does it mean when you have one people occupying another people? What does it mean when you have no idea why, but God brings this plague to the Israelites because they didn't follow what God had wanted them to be doing? What does it mean when Miriam is covered in leprosy? All of these things that may be speaking exactly to what you're looking at or other things, but those are the stories that we grapple with and that we struggle with. So we have the time of the golden calf, and the Israelites got the Ten Commandments, or got, I would say, all of the tradition, and at Mount Sinai, Moses comes down, and what does he see? He sees all the people who have taken their gold jewelry and have put it into a pot and have created this golden calf, and they're praying to it. And this is a really, really troubling thing. Moses smashes the commandments, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. And Moses and God are talking about, well, God just wants to give up and destroy the people, and Moses says no. There's all these different stories, and stories that we grapple with. So to say, what is the current thought about that? You know, I'm not sure how to answer that, unless you have a really specific question.
Do they have a certain truth that went in over the desert?
So are you asking what's not necessarily in the text, but what have we sort of learned from archaeology, that kind of thing?
Well, what do you
Okay, so great. So that's a great question, and I'm going to give you a great rabbinic answer. There are many different thoughts. The reason why is because we've got the Torah, which I explained, and we could open it up and we could look and see exactly what the texts say, whether it was a trickle or there was everyone, and to be honest, I would have to look that up. What I'm guessing we're going to find is that we're not going to find an answer there. However, we might find someone like Rashi, who comes along in the medieval period. Rashi's going to say, wait a minute, how did they get from this place to this place? That doesn't make sense. Oh, it must be because of this. Did you hear about this story here? And he's going to dig up some midrash, some story from the time of the Talmud. And he's going to work that in. So then you're going to have Rashi's commentary. But there may be some other rabbi who doesn't agree. Maybe a rabbi named Ibn Ezra. Maybe he didn't agree with Rashi. He might have had a really different take on that. So he had his text. And so, on the one hand, it's very frustrating because I'm not giving you a one precise answer. Some things I might be able to do that with, but I can't do that with this. On the other hand, what's really great is that we have lots and lots of different answers, and those are with those answers are where the meaning comes. The meaning comes from studying the different commentaries, from scratching our heads and thinking, well, wait a minute, that commentary doesn't really make sense. You know, Rashi's argument isn't really that strong here. Oh, but I found this one. And you know what? I really think it's this. And I just read in the New York Times about this new archaeological discovery. How does that jive with Rashi? And so that's the process of Torah study. So I'm sorry, I can't, if I were a biblical scholar, I might be able to help you a lot more. I'm not a biblical scholar, though, so.
Yeah, I think you're actually giving us a very valid point, though, is that in terms of having basics of Jewish religion and the kind of faith development and spiritual inquiry you do, a small piece of it may have to do with what actually happened, what archaeologists are discovering and else, but more important are the lessons that can be drawn from these ancient stories and the ways that we can then apply them to our own circumstances today. And it's a matter of curiosity to all of us, I think, you know, what is archaeology, what is historical story to say about the evolution of Judaism, you know, from the time of the Exodus to the time of the destruction of the Temple. But that history is not so central as the kinds of existential lessons and inquiries that you're making into that text.
Right. Yeah. For example, none of my congregants have never asked me that question, which means that...
That's a good question. Why would
you? Right. So what that tells me is that, one, it's a good question. Two, it may not be a central question to, you know, what we talk about each week at Torah study. But good question. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was wondering if you
could
tell us a little about the history of the temples.
Oh, goodness gracious. All this temple stuff. The history of the temple.
I want to know about its beginning and how it is at the present moment.
When you say the temple, you mean the temple in Jerusalem that was destroyed. Okay. Let's see here. You know what? I'm not the right person to answer that question. And again, it's going to be very similar to my question with you, or my answer with you. We don't really focus that much. Let me tell you something. If I were Orthodox and I were really, I cared a lot about rebuilding the third temple, because remember, there's been two temples. Two temples, both were destroyed. There's a fringe element in Judaism, ultra-Orthodox, who want right now to rebuild the third temple. They really care about all of this temple history. They care about it because they want to rebuild it. Right now what we have, the temple, is the Western Wall. Has anybody here ever been to Jerusalem? Okay, so it's a beautiful, beautiful city. And if you go to the Western Wall, you'll see Jews who are praying at it. And it's just one side of the wall. And men are on one side and women are on the other side. And for the Jews who pray at that, it's a very sacred, sacred place. And so as far as contemporary, where we're at with the temple, that's where we're at. I can tell you all sorts of terrible stories about how women want to be praying at the wall, and they want to pray with the Torah. And a lot of the men who are praying at the wall find that very offensive. And this is a terrible legal battle that's gone back and forth in Israeli courts. Are women allowed to sing out loud at the wall, or do they have to be very quiet? That's probably not what you're asking. But when I think of the contemporary issues around the temple, the temple's no longer standing. We have this wall, and this wall that is very sacred. I think, my personal opinion is that I've lived in Jerusalem. I lived there 1 year, and I lived in Haifa 1 year. And it's an amazing, amazing place. But for me, my Judaism is not, or my spiritual path, or my Jewish spirituality, is not central to the wall. I went there and I davened there, a Yiddish word for the word pray. But, you know, I felt like it wasn't where I felt comfortable. And so what we have, but there is this temple there, and again, it is very sacred in the Jewish tradition. But then we have all throughout the world different Jewish communities who have created their own temples, and in the Reform branch of Judaism, Reform Jews call their place of worship a temple because they're deriving it from that place in Jerusalem. So I'm not going to answer all your questions about the history of the temple because I will probably get the details wrong. So maybe that's something for the future that I could study it and then come in, but I can't do it on the fly. Yeah.
In the Philippians, I imagine that many people are interested not only in death, if you started out in the first part of the talk, but also in after death. And I wonder what the Jews, current Jews, believe in the afterlife, in heaven and hell, and is there an eternal life after death, so forth.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you again, not one answer, but again, many answers, because there's no one Jewish belief about what happens when you die. That being said, there are many texts that give us that have formed a lot of different Jewish beliefs. When I was growing up, my mother taught me, when you die, your body decomposes, you become dirt, and that's it. That's how I was raised. So that is, that was probably the product of her generation of very assimilated American Jews. That is not what I believe as a rabbi, and that's not what I teach in my congregation. But I say that because that's what was a perfectly normal response for her. She just didn't believe anything. However, there are many different Jewish texts. We don't believe in heaven and hell like in Christianity. If you, I don't believe that if I do something wrong or I don't live up to the best person that I can be, that I'm going to go to hell. We don't at all have that concept in Judaism. The idea is you should be the very best person you can be, but that is, and you should do that just because you should do that, because it is our quest to become and live out the best people that we can be, but it's not, we don't have this concept of hell, that you're going to go to hell if X, Y, and Z. After you die, there were Kabbalists, there were mystics who lived in the medieval period. They believed in very, very much in this afterlife, and that souls would be recycled. There are some Jewish texts that even talk about reincarnation. Again, if you walk into a synagogue and say to a rabbi, tell me about reincarnation, the rabbi is going to probably scratch your head and say, reincarnation isn't a normative Jewish belief, but there are these Jewish texts about reincarnation. A lot of it is folklore. A lot of it is, my mother-in-law recently told me, there's a Jewish tradition that when a baby is born, you name the baby after a relative who has died. And my mother-in-law recently told me, she said, my brother-in-law named his baby after her mother. And she said, my mother can now rest in peace because he's been because this new baby was named after her. I think that's folklore. I've never read that in any Jewish tradition or any texts. But folklore is really powerful. When my mother told me that I'm going to just turn into dirt, that's folklore. So there's many different ideas. But again, there are ideas very much that there is an afterlife, that there's a place called Olam Haba, which is the world to come, and that is the next world, so that when we die, we do go to this next world. There's a lot of different ideas about what that might be, about what that means. There's a lot more focus on the world that we live in now, but we very much have this idea of an afterlife, and of Olam Haba, the world to come. And if when a very, very close relative, like a parent, dies, it's traditional to say Kaddish, which is the prayer for the dead, that you say every single day for 11 months after that person dies. Now, some people do it once a week, or some people maybe once a month, but people will say Kaddish all throughout that time, because it's a matter of remembering that person. And through our memories, does that person live on? Through naming, does that person live on? And souls, very much that Judaism does believe in souls, and that they're in Olam Haba, in the world to come.
Thank you. Just to add a word to that, I think the biblical scholars are pretty much in agreement that the whole notion of individual salvation is rather close to the late development in the Jewish text. And if you look back at the covenant promises made to Moses and a variety of other figures, salvation is usually construed as being a collective affair. We'll give to you, I, Lord your God, will give you a land of your own and make you a great people. And so the idea that you had any individual survival apart from the survival of the Hebrew or the Jewish people or the community itself is relatively foreign. And maybe around the 3rd century, you begin to get texts that seem to indicate a belief in individual salvation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's probably still in the Jewish world to think of salvation as a collective thing as opposed to something that has to do with individual souls.
Sure. Oh, I think he's going around.
My question has to do with the Torah studies.
Uh-huh.
What are the qualifications for being able to attend Torah studies? Do you have to have been born a bat mitzvah? Is it open to study groups, male and female, or are they separate? Do you have to be Jewish to attend that Torah study group?
All right. All you have to do is you have to know when we're meeting and where we're meeting, and you got to walk in the door, and you're welcome.
In English, what do you mean?
My congregation is, when we do Torah study, we sit with both the English and the Hebrew. There's a lot of people in our congregation who are not fluent in the Hebrew or not even comfortable reading the Hebrew or can't even read any Hebrew. So we do rely a lot on the English translation. One of the things we do is we use a lot of different English translations because that then helps us really understand that there are many different ways of understanding the Hebrew. So you do not have to have had a bar bat mitzvah, which is a ceremony that happens when you're 13 years old. You do not have to be Jewish. And in liberal congregations, men and women do study together. If you went to an Orthodox congregation, men and women do not study together. So there might be a men's Torah study group and a women's Torah study group. But again, because I work at a very liberal congregation, anybody is welcome, and we don't separate by gender or anything like that.
Evolution and creationism?
Ah, good questions. Okay, so we have a holiday called Simchat Torah, where we got to the very end of the Torah, we got to the end of Deuteronomy, and at this holiday, we roll the Torah back. The Torah is very long, well, five books of the Bible, and it's all on this sacred scroll. And so as part of our holiday celebration, we roll the Torah back to the very, very, very beginning. That happened just, a week and a half ago or so. So we are at the very beginning, and on Simchat Torah, we read about the beginning. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So, that's what we read every year on Simchat Torah, and then we read it again on Shabbat, right after that. We read it all the time. So the question is, what do you do with that? Do we really believe that God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day God rested? So, there are, again, many interpretations. However, I think Judaism, even the people who are the most observant and the most traditional, are going to part ways with their Christian counterparts who are, we'd say, fundamentalists or the most traditional Christians, in that in the Jewish community, there aren't really people who believe, who really are holding on to this whole idea of creationism, that God created the world in 6 days and on the seventh day God rested. Our most traditional Jews in our communities might say, This is a text. Of course God created the world. God created the universe. However, there's a lot to study here. How long is a day? Maybe one day is a billion years. We don't know how long one day is. If you read the creation story and you read it carefully, there are all of these nuances. What does it mean when God rested? What does it mean when God created the lights, then there was day and there was nighttime, all of that. What does it mean when God said it was good? There's all of these different components of the creation story. We also read about Adam and Eve in the creation story. What does that mean that we had two people originally? So I would say the most traditional Jews would say that it happened like that, that God did create the world, that there was Adam and Eve, that there was the Garden of Eden, but that does not mean that evolution did not happen, that somehow those two things are perfectly acceptable to believe both of those because of our tradition of interpretation and of commentaries and of stories. And so I'm talking to most traditional Jews. Me, I believe in evolution. I learned it in school when I was in, fifth grade, and that's what I believe. And I would say, of the vast majority of Jews, if not, I don't think you can ever say 100% of Jews believe anything the same, but the vast, vast, vast majority of Jews believe in evolution, and that being said, also believe that the Torah is sacred, also believe that there was some sort of creation in some way, and we can interpret that in lots of different ways. We don't have those conflicts in our communities like in Christian communities. Yeah.
Can you give us some idea of how the internal structure of Judaism came about, the differences in the three groups, and how typical members of each group regard the other groups?
Good question. Yeah, that's great. Okay, so I think to answer that, we have to look a little bit at Jewish law. So what we call halakha. Jewish law, the very traditional belief is that there are 613 commandments in the Torah, only about 300 of which are maybe applicable today, but there's 613 commandments, and Judaism is a law-based religion. So all of tradition has revolved around these laws, and that being said, those laws informed Jewish communities very much until, I want to say, the modern period, when you have the creation of nation states. Now, why would the creation of nation states have anything to do with these laws? And they did because all of a sudden, before, like in the medieval period, you had the Jewish community, the Muslim community, and the Christian community. And these, if you look at medieval Spain, all of these people were within their own communities. And so Judaism was the Jewish community was very much, people believed the same thing, acted in the same way, not 100%, especially not as much as we might like to think. But it was much more cohesive. What happened when the creation of the nation states happened, individual communities, like the Jewish community, no longer ruled the Jews, but instead you had the French government, or the British government, or the German government, who was then determining the law for the Jews. And so that opened up Judaism in many, many, many different ways. It changed Judaism profoundly, because all of a sudden, you had Jews who were attending secular universities in, let's say, the 1800s, 1900s. And in secular universities, they were learning all sorts of different things. And that created, there was something called the Haskalah, which is the Jewish Enlightenment. And all of a sudden, Jews were studying secular poetry. They were being influenced by other religions, which also did happen in the medieval period, definitely, but to a much larger extent. And so you had the creation of Reform Judaism. In response to Reform Judaism, you then had the creation of Orthodox Judaism. Now, Orthodoxy will say that they are direct descendants of, you know, the medieval Jews and all the way, and they're the ones who had it right. But they were actually a modern movement that was created in response to Reform Judaism. And then, once in the United States, you also had the creation of Conservative Judaism, because the Reform Jews were too Reform and the Orthodox Jews were too Orthodox, and so then there was another branch. So the three main branches, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodoxy, but then, lest we think it's that simple, then there was a rabbi named Mordechai Kaplan who was trained in an Orthodox school, but he worked at the Conservative Seminary for about 60 years, and then he went on and created his own branch of Judaism called Reconstructionism, which is my tradition. And so, and that's only maybe, the school was founded in 1968, so that's very new. So there are what we would say now four branches of Judaism: Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, and Reconstructionist. Reform tends to be the most liberal. The idea is that to boil down Reform Judaism, Reform Jews believe in ethical monotheism. Ethical meaning, you got to be a good person. Monotheism, believe in one God. Okay, so that's the core of Judaism. Now, from that, there's many different ideas. So you should pray in the religion in which you speak, which is why a lot of Reform temples, there's not a lot of Hebrew. But that's even changing. There's more and more Hebrew even in Reform temples. Conservative Judaism and Reform Judaism was not interested in being halachic, meaning following Jewish law. They said, maybe it's an inspiration, but we're not going to follow Jewish law. And in fact, there's stories about how at the rabbinical school, they served pork once. Pork is not kosher and something that you would not typically serve at a rabbinical school. Conservative Judaism said, let me start with Orthodoxy, said, we still follow halakha, we are halachic Jews, we follow all the commandments that we're possibly able to follow, our services are 100% in Hebrew, and on Shabbat, which is the Jewish Sabbath, we will follow those laws precisely. We won't drive, we won't spend money, we won't turn on lights, we won't all sorts of different things, many different laws. Conservative Judaism came along and said, you know, Jewish law has always changed throughout the centuries, and we are still halachic, we still follow Jewish law, but we understand that Jewish law can change a little bit faster than what Orthodoxy would see. And so there's a panel of 25 rabbis who determine what new approaches to Jewish law. And I'll give you an example. Very recently, I think last December, there was in the conservative movement, the rabbis came out with a statement on being able to ordain gay and lesbian rabbis. And that was, nobody thought it was going to happen that soon. Reform and Reconstructionist, those movements had already said Reform, had already said their rabbis could be gay or lesbian and could be ordained as such and openly. But the conservative movement really held out, and their process was much more about studying the law and figuring out a way to make the law work with their communities and what they see solve their issues. Orthodoxy said, no way. There's no way that you can, it says a man shall not lie with a man, it says that in Leviticus. Therefore, all bets are off the table, and we're going to stay with this law as we see. So that's actually a really good example of the differences in the movements. Reform Judaism had said, we live in the modern period, we're going to change, we're going to ordain them, and we're not going to pay that much attention to Leviticus. Reconstructionists said, you know, we really value Jewish law. At the same time, we're going to study that law, we're going to interpret that law. We're also going to bring in psychology, sociology, current American demographics. We're going to interview Jews in our own communities. And so that was sort of our process. We're going to look at our Jewish values, and we're going to understand that values change over the centuries. So that, now, all that being said, if you walk into a Reform temples, you might see an organ. There's going to be a lot of English. Again, sometimes there's going to be more Hebrew, a little bit more. If you walk into a conservative synagogue, it's going to be 95% Hebrew, and you're welcome to come into, those buildings on Shabbat when there are services. If you walk into an Orthodox congregation, it would probably be, instead of like one person saying, please turn to page 59, you know, usually the rabbi, instead it's the men are going to be on one side, the women are going to be on another side, or even sometimes behind, and people are going to be going at their own pace. And at one point, someone may call out, page 59, but people are going to be just davening, praying on their own, and it's a much less formal way. Reconstructionism, again, we have more Hebrew than Reform, a little bit less than conservative. We also tend to be a little bit more informal than either Reform or conservative or Orthodox.
Yeah.
I think
secondary.
Oh.
One of the outlook of these
very. Oh, towards each other. Ah. We like to think that we're one happy family and we get along really well. That being said, I would say, basically we do. There's no. There are certain issues that are very contentious, and they're not issues that you all probably think about very often. One is, who is a Jew? Jewish law says you are a Jew if your mother was Jewish or if you convert to Judaism. Those are the only two, your mother was Jewish or you convert to Judaism. The only two ways you can be Jewish. And all the movements say you can convert to Judaism. That's not the issue. Reform and Reconstructionist Judaism came along, I think, in the 80s, maybe the 90s, but I think the 80s, and said you can be Jewish if your mother or your father is Jewish, again, or if you convert to Judaism. So that created quite an uproar in the Jewish community because it's a question of who's considered Jewish. And for Orthodox rabbis, that's a very difficult question because it determines what prayers you're allowed to say, if a child can have a bar bat mitzvah, because if they're not Jewish, they can't have a bar bat mitzvah. But you have a whole bunch of Jews who consider themselves Jewish, and all of a sudden, there's a rabbi who says, no, you're not Jewish. And they said, yeah, but my father was Jewish. So there's a lot of tension there. Also, whose conversion counts? Because I'm a woman, if I do a conversion, an Orthodox rabbi isn't going to help me because I'm not legally able to do that. there are plenty of people who have converted with me who very much see themselves as Jewish, and conservative and reform rabbis also consider them to be Jewish. These are just some of the differences we have. However, there are certain things that we agree with totally, and in many families you have parents are Orthodox, but the kids decided to become Reform, or vice versa, or a brother decides to become Orthodox, or somebody moves to Israel and then becomes either totally secular or totally Orthodox. So within families, there's a lot of diversity, which makes it difficult, because let's say a child comes home for Thanksgiving and no longer will eat in his parents' house because the food isn't kosher. Different things like that. You know, some of the tense things are Orthodoxy still doesn't recognize women as rabbis. So that's where some of the tensions are. That being said, we pretty much as possible, we try to get along anyway.
A little bit of an exception to that. To what extent are there one or the other of the traditions that tend to be more supportive of Israel and the whole Zionist set of issues that are so contentious in this country?
Good question. I don't know how to answer that easily because, look, if you are... Okay, there are Reform Jews who are extremely right-wing Zionist, and there are conservative Jews who are peacenicks, who are very dovish on Israel. Ultra-Orthodox Jews, some of them, there's a belief that, very, very, very traditionally, that there can't be a state of Israel until the Messiah comes, because in Jewish tradition we're still waiting for Messiah. So when you had a bunch of secular Jews in 1948 saying we have a Jewish state, they thought that was heresy, utter heresy, terrible for these ultra-Orthodox Jews. Over the last 60 years, some of them have totally flip-flopped and have become extremely Zionist. The best example is Chabad, which is one form of ultra-Orthodox Judaism. You also have other ultra-Orthodox Jews who, I kid you not, will burn the Israeli flag in the streets on Israel Independence Day, both in Brooklyn and Jerusalem and a few other places around the world. And so they're extremely anti-Zionist. Reconstructionist Jews tend to be more progressive, more liberal on negotiating peace between Israelis and Palestinians. And I would say some Reform, some conservative. Orthodoxy is pretty much right-wing, I would say, on that.
I always thought a rabbi had to be a man.
Here I am.
What happened?
What happened? Well, there was a woman named Sally Prefans who said, wait a minute, I want to be a rabbi. Why is it only men who get to be rabbis? She applied to rabbinical school and was accepted, and this is in the Reform movement, and in 1973 became the first woman rabbi. And because of her, and because she muddled through with being the only woman in her class for 5 years, I was now able to easily become a rabbi. Nobody ever questioned the fact that I was a woman. And in my class, we actually had more women than men. It didn't just happen out of the blue. It happened because in 1922, actually, a woman named Judith Eisenstadt Kaplan, who was the daughter of Mordechai Kaplan, who founded the Reconstructionist movement, she was the very first woman ever to have a bat mitzvah. And she did that because her father was this very intellectual rabbi who was really rethinking Judaism and didn't understand why his daughter couldn't have a bat mitzvah. So she started the trend, and then over the next many, many years, all of a sudden you have all these girls who are having a bat mitzvah. And so girls started being educated much, much more. Like my mother didn't have a bat mitzvah. She grew up Orthodox, and she never even thought about it. She might have attended some school here and there, religious school, but it just wasn't an issue. And so, but then you have all these girls who are studying for a bat mitzvah, who can read Hebrew just like the boys can, who can engage in Torah study just like the boys can. And then you have, you know, you have the 60s, and women are becoming, are entering into other professions. And so it sort of started to beg the question, well, if the girls are learning just as well as the boys, and in the larger society, women are entering all the other professions, well, why couldn't a woman become a rabbi? So first it happened with Reform, then it happened with Reconstructionists. 1982. Early 80s, the first conservative woman became a rabbi, and one of my teachers was the very first woman to ever work in a conservative synagogue. And that was, you know, groundbreaking news. And still to this day, we don't have any women who are Orthodox rabbis. However, I think within my lifetime, I'm going to see it. There are women in the Orthodox community who are so knowledgeable, who are so talented, that I think within my lifetime, I will see an Orthodox woman rabbi.
Reminds me of the movie, Yentl.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Laurie.
You're welcome. Thank you.